Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. May God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Justice Abbott has the flu, but he will participate in the deliberation and decision of this case. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Commission for Lawyer Discipline versus Barry Denton.
May it please the court, Mr. Dan Hedrick will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Hedges. I'm counsel for the petitioner, Commissioner for Lawyer Discipline. My co-counsel is Linda Acevedo. This is a unique case. This is the first time that a court of appeals has struck down as unconstitutional one of the disciplinary rules promulgated by this court. An almost identical disciplinary rule exists in 18 other states, including New York, California, and Illinois.
Your brief says still. I noticed. I didn't know if that would work. It had a lot of meaning to it. Did this rule previously exist in a greater number of states?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that. And no courts in any of those states have stricken the rule as unconstitutional.
Have there been any cases upholding the rule in any of those states?
I'm sorry, I do not know the answer to that, Your Honor. In an age of the importance of this rule is that it does relate to jurors. And jurors are the most vulnerable part of our system. The lawyers and the judges have training. The parties have lawyers representing them. The lawyers and the judges get paid to participate in the system. The jurors probably only pass through the system once. They have no training. They are essentially unpaid. They have no lawyers representing them.
If the jurors only pass through once, then how does it hurt the jury system for them to have an unpleasant experience post-service?
It would not hurt as much, perhaps, Your Honor, in Houston or Dallas, where they may very well pass through the system only once, in some of the smaller areas where they don't have as big a jury pool. The jurors will pass through the system probably a great deal more than once. You're right, the way it would hurt the jury system is for those jurors who might be coming back, because any sort of intimidation of those jurors, harassment of those jurors, is certainly going to make them, it's going to do two things to them. They will be a less willing juror to participate in the system, and if they are forced to participate, as they probably would be, there's a greater risk of them being not as impartial or as fair a juror. Very, very briefly on the facts, I know the court is familiar with them, but just to sort of set the context for our remarks, Mr. Benton was the losing lawyer in a dog bite case. And after the trial, he wrote to all of the jurors a letter in which he told them, and just a few notes from the letter, because the letter has been classified, has been characterized as political speech, and it's our position it is certainly not political speech. Some of the language from it is that he was so angry with their verdict that he couldn't speak to them after the trial. They obviously had been influenced by the lawsuit abuse campaign, that they had breached their oath to render a true verdict, that they had perverted and corrupted the civil justice system, and that they had contributed to the corruption of good government, and that they were cold and unfair. The commission filed a disciplinary petition alleging violation of Rule 3.06D. The trial court signed a judgment finding that Benton had committed professional misconduct and assessed a probated suspension. The judgment did not address the constitutionality of Rule 3.06D. The published opinion by the Corpus Christi Court only addresses one of the 4 points raised on appeal by Mr. Benton. The Corpus Christi Court's reversal and dismissal is on the sole basis that the rule is unconstitutionally vague, and it focuses on the terms harass, embarrass, and influence. The commission filed a motion for rehearing, which was overruled with slight revisions to the previously published opinion. A second motion for rehearing was filed, and in that one, the Chief Justice wrote a concurrence saying he did not believe the letter harassed and embarrassed and that he further believed that the rule, particularly the part about influence, was violative of the First Amendment. Our first point is that lawyer disciplinary rules should not be subject to the same constitutional vagueness standards as other statutes.
Let me ask a question on this. If this case was retried and then there was a verdict returned for the plaintiff, did I read that somewhere?
I don't believe it was retried, Your Honor. It was only one trial. Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about the underlying dogfight case. I was thinking the disciplinary.
No, the underlying dogfight.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. The letter, as I read, could be harassing, but could the letter be true? Could the jury have disobeyed its oath? Could the jury have ignored the instructions of the judge? Could the jury have done the things that Mr. Benton said? Do we have to come to this with the assumption that what he said was not true in order to find the letter harassing, or can the letter be harassing even if it's reflecting true facts?
Well, to begin with, unless some kind of an inquiry had been conducted of the jurors, which was not, the jurors had been somehow brought into question, I don't know how you'd ever be able to answer that question, Your Honor. We can't know that.
But to determine whether the letter is harassing or embarrassing to the jury, would we have to make a determination that what the jury is being accused of is groundless or frivolous or no basis at all?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the letter could be true, and it could still be harassing, embarrassing, and seeking to influence the jurors. Juries can be wrong. Juries are wrong from time to time. I won't say all the time, but from time to time. Juries sometimes make their decisions for the wrong reasons. I've certainly observed enough mock trials with the video and all that. I've seen mock juries arrive at decisions for incredibly wrong reasons. But, they have still served as a jury. They have still performed a function in our system. Hopefully what the jury who did something wrong has done will be overturned, but their process is for overturning it. That's what the appellate process is for. Even those jurors who are wrong deserve protection within the system and should not be harassed. I think the short answer to Your Honor's question is, I think the rule should apply even if what the letter says is true. It can still be a harassing letter. I see no reason why it should not be. The cases involving Judge Howell in the Fifth Circuit and in the Tyler Court of Appeals, I think, give us the best description of why the rules that would apply to regulations of lawyers in determining whether they are vague is not the same vagueness test that would be applied to a criminal statute. A criminal statute applies to all of the people. It applies to people with absolutely no legal training whatsoever. That's mostly who it applies to. Regulations of lawyers are regulating people who have a special education, they have a special training, they have access to special resources. So while the customary rule is whether or not a person exercising ordinary common sense can sufficiently understand and comply with without sacrifice to the public interest of the regulation, that is not the rule for lawyers. That should not be the rule for lawyers. The rule for lawyers should be whether a lawyer, with the training, experiences, and resources available to him or her, should be able to understand and comply with the rule. The Corpus Christi Court of Appeals talked about the ordinary rule and said a few things about how lawyers should be treated differently, but when they got down to the end of their determination of vagueness, they applied the ordinary man test and did not apply the test as to lawyers.
Is there any difference between going up to a juror immediately after the trial and writing them a letter months later?
Not under the terms of the rule, Your Honor. I don't think it would be. You have to have a lawyer who tried the case. You have to have jurors who are on the jury in that case. Those are two of the elements of the rule. So it's a very, very narrow, limited rule in who it applies to. And then it says the lawyer shall not ask questions of or make comments to a member of that jury that are calculated to harass. So I would think even a letter several months later, if It is a communication to one of the jurors in that case where he was the lawyer, and it has the effect of harassing or embarrassing, would still
and
be a violation.
You haven't the word merely yet, merely to harass or embarrass.
Your Honor, I think in this particular case, if you substituted the word solely for the word merely, you would still come out with the same result. That this letter served no purpose other than that. As I said at the outset, some effort's been made to portray it as political speech. The only way you can do that at all is it does have the words lawsuit abuse in the letter, but it doesn't talk about the lawsuit abuse campaign. It doesn't explain what it is. It doesn't say whether Mr. Benton is for it or against it. All he in essence says is your decision is so incredibly wrong and stupid. The only thing I can think of to explain it is that you've been victimized by the lawsuit abuse campaign.
It is informational, isn't it, that the judge set aside what the jury did?
That
information juries might helpful.
That also, I don't think it was... In the context of the whole letter, Your Honor, it would not appear that was done to be informational and helpful. It appears in the context of the overall letter that it isn't just me who's saying how wrong you were. You were so wrong that the judge threw out your verdict. We had to have another trial, and all the time we spent was completely wasted.
Given the word merely, if half the letter had been like this, that is, you're corrupt or aiding and abetting corruption, and the other half had been a learned exegesis of the effects of the Citizens Against Lawsuit Abuse campaign and all verdicts and all, would it then come outside this proscription?
The commentary would indicate that is not the case, Your Honor. The commentary would say if the letter has the effect of embarrassing, harassing, or seeking to influence, and influence clearly means influence in a negative manner, not influence in a positive manner.
How can you tell that it clearly indicates in a negative manner? One of the complaints that Mr. Benton makes is that this particular rule is subject to discriminatory enforcement.
That's correct, Your Honor. If you look at the purpose of the rule, as stated in the commentary, the purpose of the rule is fair and impartial justice and to encourage jurors to participate. So it would be totally contrary to the purpose of the rule to say that a letter influencing them to participate willingly in the system was violative of the rule. The purpose of the rule is not to discourage them. So a letter, such as the letter that was involved here, that simply said, thank you very much for your service, I hope you will continue to serve in the future, that kind of a letter actually works towards the purpose of the rule. So if we look at the words in context, we look at harass, embarrass, and influence, and we look at the purpose of the rule, I think it's pretty clear that the rule is intended to dissuade lawyers from trying to intimidate people to stay off of juries, not to in any way punish lawyers who write letters thanking people for their jury service and encouraging them to serve.
Well, in this case, the defense lawyer wrote a letter lauding the jury and their efforts and felt they did a good job. Why doesn't that violate the rule if it's, quote, intending to influence the jury on this viewpoint of the case?
Well, I think, Your Honor, because, as I just said, the purpose of the rule is to encourage jurors to willingly serve.
You did such a good job. I hope you'll remember me the next time we have you on the jury and things like that. That's a positive thing.
I don't think that would be violative of the rule, Your Honor. I think that would not be discouraging them from jury service.
So how
that would be encouraging jury service.
How does somebody that's supposed to be enforcing it know, under the circumstances, whether you do or you don't, and that's one of the complaints made in this case, that there's uneven enforcement?
It's not uneven, Your Honor. It's totally even and consistent with the purpose of the rule. And the purpose of the rule is to encourage jurors to continue to serve. When you keep that purpose of the rule in mind, and then you read the rule with that purpose of the rule.
Well, wait a minute. If the letter says, I'm delighted you returned a zero verdict, and you'll be glad to know that in the last 2 years, the jurors of this county have returned 50% zero verdicts, and that's kept your insurance premiums only risen 2% instead of 8% like they rose before. If all jurors work together to keep these verdicts down, we'll all live happily ever after. Wouldn't that be calculated to influence the jurors' actions in future jury service?
I think it might be calculated to encourage them to be willing jurors in the future.
Well, there's an R in here. you're looking at harass or embarrass the juror, but things that are to influence his action in future jury service.
And I, at the risk of repeating myself, Your Honor, the best answer I have to that is to look to the commentary. And remember, we are dealing with lawyers, and lawyers are supposed to know how to look to the commentary and read the commentary. Lawyers are supposed to be able to understand the purpose of the rule, interpret the rule in accordance with the purpose of the rule. And the purpose of the rule is to keep the lawyers from writing negative letters to jurors, influencing them so they will not serve on juries.
What the, if a judge is granted a new trial, and that is just communicated to the jurors, in other words, your jury verdict was disregarded by this judge, and I just wanted you to know that. Do you think that negatively influences them to not want to serve again?
I think that question, put side by side with the question from the Chief Justice earlier, and that is certainly a tougher question to answer than this letter in its entirety would be. But certainly an argument could be made that's informational. I think an argument could also be made that it served no purpose other than to say, aha, see, you were wrong. But it would certainly be a much closer question than what we have before us today.
But a letter that says you were wrong is a different letter than a letter that says you are corrupt.
You are corrupt, you are cold and unfair. I hope if you are ever exposed to the system and you think the system is crooked, you'll look back on how you corrupted the system in this instance. It's very harsh language in this letter. It is really nothing but a very harsh personal attack on the jurors. I would argue viewing that letter in its whole is exactly the kind of letter that the rule is designed to prevent and the kind of conduct that jurors should be protected from.
Even in the few short years since we promulgated this rule, there's been a strong move in the federal courts to extend full speech rights to lawyers and judges. Several provisions of the Code of Judicial Conduct have fared poorly in courts around the nation. Aren't we in the middle of a strong trend that way? Law is just a business. You don't give up any civil liberties in exchange for this piece of paper, this license to do this business.
I would agree there is a trend in that direction, Your Honor. But certainly we still have cases coming out regularly. I would refer the court to the case that I sent a copy to the court of after the briefs were filed, Marynell Maloney case out of San Antonio, where certainly I think federal and state courts are still taking the position that if you are going to get the benefits of participating as a lawyer in the judicial system, you are going to have to abide by the rules of that system. You are going to have to abide by certain disciplinary rules, and disciplinary rules on lawyers, essentially by definition, are limited on speech. Lawyers don't have much but speech.
The Maloney case, as in our recent Hanner case, it did involve speech directly to the court, in essence within the courtroom, as opposed to outside speech.
Your Honor, two responses to that. Number one, if you're kind of looking at the relative strengths of the parties and their abilities to deal with one another, I would argue to the court that judges are in a far stronger position to deal with abusive lawyers than jurors are. The judges have sanctions they can impose on the lawyers. The judges are lawyers. The judges have the same training, if not better training, than the lawyers do. With all due respect to the court deserves proper treatment and proper respect. The jurors have no protections. They don't have the training. They don't have any sanctions they can render. So I would argue that when the court is considering the subject, and I know the court is doing as we speak, of the interrelationship between what lawyers can say to judges, greater protection should be granted to jurors. And to the extent they were outside the system, there are other laws and rules that still give protection to jurors after they have returned their verdict. They should not simply be let go and unprotected by the system. On the criminal side, we have the retaliation rules. If somebody is a juror in a criminal case and they've rendered their verdict and they walk outside the courtroom and the lawyer walks up and slaps them in the face, instead of a misdemeanor assault, he's got a felony retaliation statute that he's looking at. So this is certainly not the only rule or regulation we have to protect jurors after they have performed their services. And I would argue, Your Honor, one of the protections they ought to have is once they've entered their verdict, they ought to be free from the system. They ought to be able to get back to their lives and go on about their business. And this kind of harassment impinges upon their ability to do so.
Let me ask you a question about the record. And focusing on political speech, you cannot help anytime you go to the Valley to see these billboards, which are not only in the Valley. As I traveled throughout the state in my campaign, I was surprised that they're in Houston, Dallas, in East Texas. I mean,
I see them on the way to Beaumont every time I go there.
They're everywhere. And not only the campaign against lawsuit abuse, but they're a competing billboard, an answer to those billboards. So, and there have been a lot of articles written about it. There have been editorials written about it. So there have been a lot of coffee shop talk about this campaign. What does the record show with regards to that? And if the record doesn't show anything about that, to what extent can we take judicial notice of these things as we weigh whether or not this is protected speech, political speech or not?
There was some talk about that, I believe, in the record, Your Honor, but mostly I've been focused in my presentation today and our brief focusing on the letter itself, and is the letter really a discussion of the lawsuit abuse issue? I think that's a perfectly valid issue, obviously, for political speech discourse, but it is mentioned only once in this letter, and that sentence is, you know, I can't think of any possible explanation on God's green earth for you doing something as stupid as you did other than you must have been influenced by the lawsuit abuse campaign. It's not a discussion of that campaign, Your Honor. A discussion of that campaign in the billboards, a discussion of that campaign in the letters to the editor, and other contexts would probably be valid public speech. But here, what particularly strikes me, Your Honor, on the First Amendment analysis of this, and part of that is it political speech, but part of that is how narrow is this restriction. This rule applies to a very, very small number of people. It doesn't apply to all lawyers. It only applies to lawyers who have tried a particular case in front of a particular jury. And it only restricts them as to their expression of opinion as to 12 people. Really 12 people on earth who they cannot say some of these things to. Otherwise, they can go on television and say it. They can put it on a billboard. They can put it in the newspaper. But the rule is that for those 12 people who have made their contribution to the system, they should be able to go free and not have anything more to do with it and leave them alone. So it is a remarkably narrowly drawn restriction. And I think that is critical in any First Amendment analysis.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Ed Stiganowicz, this is an argument for the respondent.
Hey, please, the court. I'm Edmund Stiganowicz, counsel for Mr. Benton. What I'd like to first do is just touch upon some of the questions that you asked, because I think you're right in tune on some of the arguments and important issues. In fact, the trial, Judge Hester granted a new trial in this case, and it was actually settled after jury selection the second time around. But I want to first start with what Mr. Benton has said all along, that he regrets writing the letter. I mean, he obviously made a mistake, and he would never do that again. He felt sincerely that he was voicing his opinion about political speech. I don't think there's any question that lawsuit abuse is a political speech issue. I believe that this court had a case in front of it just a couple days ago, which shows on the ramifications of lawsuit abuse.
Right. If he felt so bad about it and got a probated sentence, then he's not going to do it again. Why are we here? You know?
Well, Mr. Benton, actually, if you brought that up, Ron, he was willing to take a public reprimand, and they insisted that they wanted to prosecute him and put him at least on probation.
I thought you briefed a private reprimand.
Private reprimand, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Has any of the sentence been served, or was it superseded?
It's been put on hold.
So it's still a live controversy.
Yes.
If we were to reverse the court of appeals, he'd have a one-year probation.
Yes, with some other conditions that I wanted to talk to you about he was ordered to prepare a video regarding on how you should contact jurors. I mean, what do we tell law students or other lawyers on how to contact jurors if the law itself or the rule itself is vague? Also, the record at trial contained numerous materials regarding the lawsuit abuse campaign and articles and things like that. So, again, I don't think there's any question that it's political speech. Your Honor had a great question about a lawyer contacting a juror right after the trial as opposed to a letter. There's great authority for the proposition that a letter is the least intrusive means of invasion of privacy, if it even is that. that a juror could discard a letter seeing that it was from Mr. Benton or not even read it, as opposed to being grabbed in a hallway and saying, listen, what you did is wrong.
Isn't there an answer to that, that maybe right after the verdict, then you're caught up in emotions, but 4 months later, it was like a pretty deliberate thought to write a letter of that nature?
Right, and actually, it was months after the case was concluded, which means it would have no bearing at all on the present litigation. Also, the commentary states something about, he was talking about, opposing counsel, about the purpose of the rule, but part of it says that the purpose of the rule is to protect the feelings of jurors. And with all due respect, feelings of jurors or feelings of people sometimes have to be overweighed or outweighed by the constitutional provisions of freedom of speech and freedom of political speech.
Could the commentary be rewritten to make the rule constitutional?
You know, well, I was thinking about, you asked me regarding maybe he shouldn't contact jurors at all, because a lot of jurisdictions are doing the federal court system, and those cases have been upheld. It may be better to have a rule where you should not contact a juror at all, as opposed to saying, well, you can contact a juror if what you tell them is nice, but you can't contact a juror if what you tell them is not nice.
Is there any correlation between a lawyer's ability to contact a juror and the ability to impeach a juror's verdict? By testimony. And what I'm getting at is this rule we have left over from the day when we allowed a post-verdict inquiry into how the juror, what the jurors considered and how they reached the verdict?
I'm not really sure about that, Your Honor. I apologize. I'm not sure I know really how to answer
I thought
that.
Of it.
Yeah. And also, Your Honor, is that the trend is correct. The laws abridging free speech, especially lawyers' free speech, have changed over the years. They have changed in favor of lawyers enjoying the full right to citizenship. And we're aware that the right to free speech is dependent largely upon your values and your opinions. And as long as the Constitution has been interpreted to mean something besides Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, it's going to be dependent upon appellate judges. And we ask that you put a high value on the free speech in Texas. The trend is growing for lawyers to be treated just like any other citizen. In the, we call the controlling case of Gentile, the court states, we have not in recent years, and this is 1991, accepted our colleagues' apparent theory that the practice of law brings it with it comprehensive restrictions, or that we will defer to professional bodies when those restrictions infringe upon the First Amendment. There cannot be any disciplinary rules that infringe upon the First Amendment rights or any constitutional rights. A lawyer is just like any other citizen, and that trend is growing and continues to grow.
So you're saying that all the federal court rules is that prohibit lawyers from contacting jurors are unconstitutional?
No, sir. Matter of fact, I think that may be a better practice because...
Well, there's certainly infringement of speech. I mean, there's a complete bar.
See, the problem here is that there's discriminatory enforcement.
Where is the discriminatory enforcement?
Well, because there's a pointed out, I think, by Her Honor that Mr. Hollis, the opposing counsel in the underlying personal injury case, wrote a letter to the juror saying, you guys did a great job, and he admitted that he wrote that to influence their jury in the future.
Well, he didn't write it to harass them.
Yeah, but he did write it to influence their future jury service, and that's what the rule prohibits.
It also prohibits harassment.
Right.
And there's no way you can read those two letters and think that the one letter is not harassing and the other letter is.
Right. But the rule, I think, as the Chief Justice pointed out, has ors in it. It's either harass, embarrass, or to influence their future jury service. Mr. Benton,
so it would be okay if it just said harassment.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Would it be okay if it just said harassment?
As long as harassment is defined to some extent.
Don't the words harass, embarrass, or influence have settled usage in Texas law? Aren't those terms used regularly in Texas law so that the usage is known?
Well, I believe the penal statutes have a specific definition of harassment. Where there is none in this case, that would be the distinction for me. I think the case that's pointed out in the brief, I think it's a long case, where most of the penal, when they use harassment, has specific definitions, where here it doesn't.
Well, but do you have to have a specific definition to go with the rule, or if the word has a common meaning, a settled usage, isn't that sufficient to avoid a successful vagueness challenge?
My response would be that to what may be embarrassing to some jurors may not be to others. Apparently 12 jurors got this letter, but only 3 of them basically complained about it, which may mean that the other 9 didn't really, weren't embarrassed or didn't feel that they were embarrassed.
Is it a subjective standard, or is it standard of...
In my mind, it's subjective. If there's what is embarrassing and harassing to one person may not be to another.
Well, because juror is, as opposed to counsel pointed out, and this may be their only time to have anything to do with the judicial system, and sometimes can be more sensitive to what goes on in the courtroom than others.
If it became a general practice among the bar that every losing lawyer wrote, threatening is the wrong word, but this type of letter to every jury panel, but that just becomes common knowledge. What's that going to do to an already declining pool of people who want to serve?
See, I think the state bar wants to argue that if you allow this law, or you reverse the Court of Appeals decision, you're going to have all kinds of lawyers write all kinds of stupid letters like this, but quite honestly, I don't think any lawyer would write a letter like this. Mr. Benton regrets it now. I don't think the court has to be concerned with opening the floodgates for lawyers criticizing jurors, because most lawyers practice in small towns, no jurors, their potential clients. No one's going to do that. I don't think that's really...
Well, somebody's going to do it, and they know not to do it. What's wrong? How can a rule that prohibits it be vague?
Well, I'd like to proceed with our argument regarding the political freedom of speech aspect.
Well, what's the answer to my question? How can it be vague if lawyers are not going to do it, they know not to do it, and they know, in the words of your brief, that it's not good professional practice to write such a letter? That's what the rules of discipline are about. What's wrong with prohibiting it? On vagueness.
On vagueness, I still think that it calls for discriminatory enforcement.
Everybody knows not to do it, but we can't prohibit it.
Well, somebody may write a letter that they think is not embarrassing, and a juror may feel maybe oversensitive and feel embarrassed. And I think there's still going to be a problem with the discriminatory enforcement of that issue.
It's virtually impossible. I mean,
and
discriminatory enforcement is virtually impossible to prove.
Well, it's very subjective. I keep repeating myself, but what may be embarrassing to me may not affect someone else.
Well, but this, as I read the rule, forget the comment. But if I read the rule, it doesn't have anything to do with what it actually does to a juror. It's what the lawyer has in his or her own mind. It's their writing. It's calculating to do it.
That may be more of a reason to hold that the rule is in fact vague and unconstitutional. It's open to different interpretations. Mr. Benton also argues that the rule allows for censorship of political speech, which is presumptively unconstitutional. There's plenty of cases on that. The growing trend, as you are aware of now, is that lawyers should be treated equally in that regard. And it denies Mr. Benton.
I mean, we put all kinds of restrictions on lawyers in terms of what speech they can make. And they're outlined, I think, in opposing counsel's brief. You've got client confidentialities for life and beyond the grave, and lots of comments you cannot make during a trial or before a trial.
And those are good rules because they could interfere with the actual the justice system. Again, this is a case where a letter was written 4 or 5 months that had nothing to do with the trial at that time.
But you stipulated it was influenced in future cases.
That's correct.
A direct impact on the system, is it not?
That was the stipulation that Mr. Benton wrote the letter to influence jurors' future service.
It is calculated to have a direct impact on an adjudication in the future.
Influence their jury service. Yes. But when the question arises between what lawyers' rights, it's usually in opposition to a fundamental right, a right to a fair trial, a right to your client's confidentiality. Here is his right to freedom of speech versus the feelings of a juror. It's not infringing on the judicial system.
You can say feelings of a juror, but we do have a stipulation that this is done intentionally to influence the outcome of their vote in another case. Now, that's not feeling, is it?
I'm not sure about it. It was done to influence their future jury service. My response would be that Mr. Hollis, the other lawyer, admitted that he wrote the letter, a letter that was very complimentary, also to influence their future jury service. And why isn't he being disciplined? He basically admitted to violating the rule himself, that he wrote it to influence them, but in a positive effect. And that's where you get into effect. Well, Mr. Benton's letter is critical. Mr. Hollis's letter is not critical. I mean, who are we to judge that? What's critical to one may not be critical to another.
But do you also have a problem that if you stipulate that you did it to influence your jury service, that you are acknowledging that you know what you said is not in response to a vague standard.
Well, we would acknowledge that he wrote it to influence the future jury service, but not to, he didn't stipulate that he wrote it to embarrass or harass.
But I understand, but it's been pointed out, the last clause of the rule says or to influence.
Right.
So you violate the rule, how is that a vague?
Because I think the part of the rule that mentions harassment and embarrassment is still vague. And I really...
Well, but in this particular case, under these particular facts, he could be found to violate the disciplinary rule without having to discuss whether harass or embarrass is involved at all, but purely based on the stipulations.
No, Mr. Fenton, I think we have three stronger arguments regarding political speech and equal protection.
Well, but we're only here right now, at least at this point, on the vagueness situation. You have to get past vagueness before you can get this court or the Court of Appeals to write again on your other three points. Isn't that right?
Well, our position is that we filed cross appeals on those three other issues, so we feel that they're in front of the court now. Also, the state bar for one of the jurisdictional aspects of even being here mentioned that there was a conflict between the justices at the Court of Appeals. Justice Searden wrote a concurring opinion that he felt maybe it wasn't vague, but it's definitely unconstitutional because it violates his freedom of speech, his right to free speech. So in my opinion, with all due respect, we feel that all those issues before the court this morning, and that's why I was trying to expand on those. We filed cross appeals on the equal protection, the freedom of speech, and that's what I was getting into, that a lawyer's rights now have become equal. The Gentile case is, I think, controlling that we're not second-class citizens any longer. Wouldn't it be ironic that lawyers who were advocates for people's rights and their constitutional rights would now be subordinate being second-class citizens themselves? That trend is changing, and it's come to a point where only clear and convincing evidence would outweigh a lawyer's right to freedom of expression, freedom of speech. The Corpus Christi, I think it's the Harney case, talked about a march on the courthouse. That would affect the administration of justice, but nothing short of that will. It's got to be imminent, and in this case, Mr. Benton has a right to express his feelings about lawsuit abuse. He sincerely felt that that's what affected the jury, which obviously made a mistake in this case. Judge Hester granted a new trial instantly. The defense at the underlying trial never even just basically stipulated to the liability. It's just a matter of how much. Mr. Benton felt that the lawsuit abuse was affecting the juror. He wrote that. The record is full of lawsuit abuse. Thus, we feel that he's expressing his right to express political speech. And that can't be infringed just because of jurors' feelings. It's got
to
be...
If he'd done this in a letter to the editor, he would have reached the same jurors, would he not? But wouldn't that be a better avenue for him to vent his political speech if that truly were his intent?
But that, I mean, that could be interpreted as also being a violation. That jurors could have read that and that you're contacting the juror. I mean, that's why that rule is so open and in my mind, vague. He could have...
But the rules are full of those kinds of things. That's all there is in them. 306A1 says you shall not conduct a vexatious or harassing investigation. Isn't that the same problem?
Yes, sir.
And there's nothing but that in there. I mean, there are a few provisions that say you shouldn't break the law, but so much of the rules is setting a standard that can't be completely, fully defined.
And I think the best argument I would have is, again, going back to the discriminatory enforcement, because we were fortunate in this case where the other lawyer actually did write a letter. And I think that says a lot, where one lawyer is writing a letter and he's getting criticized.
Are you subject to the same standards on discriminatory enforcement that a criminal defendant has to prove to strike down a prosecution because of discriminatory enforcement?
It's true. Again,
and you're familiar with those cases?
To a certain degree, Your Honor.
It's virtually impossible.
It's just, to me, it seems like it's just so subjective. But again, I think the stronger argument, so I feel that that's before the court, is the other constitutional issues, and we ask that you take serious consideration in those. The equal protection issue is, I think, a serious issue. I don't think the court should be concerned about opening the floodgates. Through all our research, there was one other incident in the entire United States where this has occurred. It was out of Indiana, the Baring case. And the court never even addressed the constitutional issues, just addressed the rule. The equal protection standard is whether there is a compelling state interest to justify treating one person. Basically, regarding the equal protection argument, anybody else in the courtroom could have contacted the jurors. the bailiff, even the parties, the judge, anybody, but only the lawyer, Mr. Benton, and any other lawyer in Texas has been prohibited from doing that. That's just not treating everyone equally, and there's no compelling state interest to treat lawyers differently. A party could have harassed the jurors, the judge could have sent letters.
Don't you think a judge sending this type of letter would, that the Judicial Conduct Commission would have something to say under some of the broader standards that
is applicable? Very likely. But the rule actually doesn't, this rule doesn't prohibit the judges from doing that.
Well, the code doesn't apply.
Well, I don't know if there's any rule that really would prohibit a judge from doing that.
Well, there's a whole bunch. I mean, people are saying, judges are sanctioned all the time for legal rules about maintaining the dignity of the office, et cetera.
To me, there just seems to be no simple, compelling justification for only censoring lawyers. The parties could have done it. The bailiff, anybody else could approach jurors, but the lawyer, and again, Mr. Benton approached his juror, the jurors long after this whole case was over. It would not have interfered with the administration of justice. What we see, a lawyer's right to free speech is different only when it conflicts with some other fundamental right, which I was talking about, a right to a fair trial, freedom of speech versus a right to a fair trial, gag orders. There are a lot of cases out of the 40s concerning where editors of newspapers were held in contempt, and those were fundamental issues. Person's right to a fair trial, client's confidences, the confidentiality of communication. When a lawyer's speech does not directly affect one of these interests, these fundamental interests, the lawyer has the same right to free speech as everyone else does, including the media. And that's what the Gentile case speaks about, and that's what that Harney case out of the Corpus Christi publisher case speaks about. The rule censors more than is necessary to promote its goal, protecting former jurors' feelings. If the rule stopped at prohibiting harassment, embarrassment, maybe it could be constitutional, but it goes much further. It prohibits speech which would influence juror service in the future. Preventing lawyers from seeking to influence former jurors in the future literally prohibits them from encouraging them to participate. Again, we feel that there's just too much leeway, and you have a complimentary letter, you have a critical letter. Mr. Benton's letter was ordered to be disciplined because of that. Mr. Hollis, who wrote the complimentary letter, wrote the letter to influence other jurors' future service.
Mr. Sandowitz, you keep focusing on similarity, the two letters, that they were both intended to influence future jury service, but you're shying away from harassment and embarrassing the jury.
Well, regarding harassment, I think it's clear that harassment has to be some sort of continuous episode. Even the penal statutes regard it annoying.
If a dog is entitled to one bite before incur liability, a lawyer is entitled to one letter.
Well, I don't think one letter constitutes harassment. One letter, depending on how subjective you are or what your personal feelings are, may be embarrassing, but I don't think one letter can be harassing. Usually harassing, that's what the question is. What does harassing mean? In my mind, it means something that's a continuous annoyance, as in the penal statutes, the stalking or the telephone harassment penal statutes. Even Judge Sheridan said one letter shouldn't be harassment. But there are constitutional issues that, besides vagueness, that we'd like you to consider, and I appreciate your time. Mr. Benton regrets the letter.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
Your Honors, I'd like to address just two procedural matters to perhaps clarify something. The Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, in its majority opinion, addressed only vagueness. It did not address the First Amendment or equal protection issues. The First Amendment issue was addressed in the concurrence. Therefore, I think if this court chooses to, this court can write its opinion based entirely upon vagueness and write a totally dispositive opinion. If the court chooses...
Well, only if we affirm.
Correct, I'm sorry. Certainly. Well, no.
If we find that this is not vague, we still cannot affirm that sentence without looking at all the other constitutional challenges which the court below didn't reach.
They are not before this court on cross appeal, Your Honor. There is no cross appeal in this case, contrary to what Mr. Saganowitz said.
Why would there have to be a cross appeal? Just cross point. Here are other reasons to uphold this verdict.
Where I'm going with this, Your Honor, is I'd love for this court to consider all those grounds, certainly as opposed to only What I would not like to see happen, Your Honor, for obvious reasons, is for this court only to consider vagueness and then send the case back to the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals to consider the First Amendment equal protection. I do think they're all before this court, and we would like to see the court consider all of them.
You don't mention in your briefing that it was a Gentile or Gentile case. How do you distinguish that?
Your Honor, I'm going to need some help on the holding on that one. I'm sorry. That is the one that...
It upheld in a criminal case that putting some restrictions on a lawyer speaking out ahead of time, but the court held that there has to be, in essence, a clear and present danger, and there has to be some substantial risk of impacting an ongoing or a proceeding.
Well, if that's a criminal statute, you've got a completely different standard than you have under the disciplinary rules.
It was a disciplinary rule that was applied to a lawyer in a criminal proceeding.
The disciplinary rule? I'm sorry, Your Honor. I have not reread the case recently. I apologize. The last point I would like to make to the court is, the court has had a lot of questions about the rule today, and it certainly is possible to improve this rule. It's probably impossible to improve all of the rules. I would suggest to the court that the court has other means available to it to improve the rules. The court has its own inherent power. A new rule can be drafted and circulated through the membership of the state bar. I think to strike down this rule is unconstitutional, which would leave us with no rule at all. It's not called for here. It's not the wise way to go. It's not the right thing to do. If the rule needs to be changed, the rule can be changed, and it should be changed through those other means.
Is there any, does this rule have any more force because in Texas, unlike any other state I've found so far, the lawyers vote on these rules?
I would certainly think so, Your Honor. The system is available to all the members to offer criticism, to participate. I've participated in some of that system in various committees appointed by this court. This isn't something that was, this court went off somewhere and just came up with these things out of nowhere. The lawyers have input.
Well, and more than input, it's a
they write
vote. It's more than writing. There's an election.
Correct.
If they're not voted for, and we're thinking about putting some changes on now that are part of a negotiation with the U.S. Attorney General. And in other states, the Supreme Court will just promulgate it if they want to, but we have to have an election.
The lawyers are both on the input side and they're on the voting side, so they help to write them. And if enough of them don't like the way they are written, they can vote them down. Obviously, that didn't happen here. I would think that would give more weight to those rules.
That concludes the arguments on this call. This call is submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and Marshall will adjourn the court.
All right. Okay.